silence. This little work, whose the centenary of whose publication we commemorate this year, it was, in effect, the last work, the last gift, I think we can say, of H.P. Blavatsky to the world. And I think one of the most deeply moving gifts, if I can put it that way. There were other writings after this, but in terms of the major works that we think of, given by HPB, this constitutes, I think, with The Key to Theosophy, her last really major work. Dara, would you agree with me too? I think there were other writings, of course, right up until close to the end, but this is it. And as she herself put it, that she was giving it in order to share with her students and with others, but with her own students, the ideas that would have most benefit for those who really were in earnest in following the theosophical path, a way of life that would lead to ever more efficient, beneficent service in the world. And so she, in effect, said that it was to answer the needs, to really speak to the needs of what she called the few real mystics in the Theosophical Society. The few real mystics. In one sense, then, it seems almost sacrilege to attempt an exposition of it from any point of view other than that of the mystical. But on the other hand, I think it is maybe helpful to look at it in this brief series in terms of what we may expect if we are determined to proceed on what we call the theosophical way. What is the theosophical life? And so I propose to treat it in terms of six particular aspects of the work, that this morning would be a kind of introduction, and looking at it in its context of a Mahayana Buddhist text. Dr. Suzuki, for example, has clearly stated that it was an authentic Buddhist philosophical text, that it's in that tradition. There can be no question. There is an edition of it known as the Peking edition, which has the, what shall we say, the approval of the then Teshu Lama. And Nicholas has that particular text, which you can look at. It is obtainable, that text is obtainable, and there are many, many different editions of the work. And we probably all, if you have the work, have different editions. I have come to, I suppose, because I've marked it up and so on, use an edition that is known as the Golden Jubilee Edition. Issued in 1939, and with copious notes by a very well-known and active theosophist who lived for many years at Adyar, A.J. Hamister, who was a member from Holland, and used the name of Arya Asanga, taking a Buddhist name and being himself having taken Panchasila, which is the five vows of Buddhism. And it has very copious notes, therefore, by him, which are useful. But I have other editions that I refer to from time to time. So it really doesn't matter too much, I think, which edition you have, as long as you have one that is, shall we say, based on the original. There are some editions in which the verses are not numbered. Now, if you have an edition that in which the verses are numbered, I think that's helpful, simply because it makes reference very easily, because obviously pagination differs from edition to edition. But if I can say verse 250, it makes it easy that we can all look that up, at least. But if you have an edition that isn't numbered, well then I'll try to locate it as best we can. I do think that it's helpful to put it into the context of the whole Buddhist tradition, and that is one of the things that I will attempt to do in some degree. Then on Wednesday, I'd like to turn our attention to a very interesting one of the statements that occurs, because I think it has a great deal of meaning and introduces us to perhaps the way in which we must move. And this is actually verse 20, which occurs in the first fragment. The Voice of the Silence is composed of three fragments, as she called them. They are translations of only some of the verses which HPB says she had to commit to memory, and that this Book of Golden Precepts, to which this work, she tells us, belonged, contains, she tells us, about 90 distinct little treatises. Of these, she learned 39 by heart, 39 treatises, I assume, therefore, which must have been quite something to have learned by heart. And of these, she translated, it would appear, I feel, only some fragments. So on Wednesday, I'd like to look at that, bestride the bird of life, and see if we can understand it. And then, even within this first fragment, she indicates that before thou settest thy foot upon the ladder's upper rung, thou hast to hear the voice of thy inner God in seven manners. So we will look at what are these sounds, what I call the sounds of the self. And then we will be looking at the second fragment next Monday, the two paths. That's what it's called, the two paths. And she differentiates these. Then I would like to look at what she calls the donning the vestures. One could perhaps interchange five and six, but there are references to the vestures that is the robes, the way in, or we could even call, I think in one sense, the appearances that one assumes, that are assumed on this traditional way, the three vestures. These are spoken of in various places in the text, and to achieve that, one must scale what she calls the paramita heights, the paramitas, and we will discuss that on our last one. I like to leave that for the last, because to me, it's the most beautiful aspect, and the most practical. It's the way in, it's given in the seven portals in fragment three. So that's the way I propose that we approach it. There, in other words, not so much by just reading through it and discussing the various verses. That would be another way, but there isn't time to do that. In the course of it, I'm sure you will come to this asking me or discussing. Perhaps I think one of the most misunderstood of all of the verses in the Voice of the Silence. The one that is quoted, that is thrown up to anybody who attempts to use his mind, perhaps, especially if you don't want to use your mind. And then you can say, well, the mind is the slayer of the real, and therefore, you know, let's abolish the mind. I will set that one to rest at once by saying, from my point of view, that by being man, we were not meant to be mindless. And actually, the whole doctrine is the mindful doctrine. It is the mind-only doctrine, as I'll suggest a little later this morning. And that, however, we have to distinguish what we mean by the mind. I think probably a great deal of the difficulty arises from the fact that in English we have just one word, mind, and it means a multitude of things to a multitude of people. Whereas, of course, in Sanskrit and, of course, Buddhism, the canon, while it is generally thought of as in Pali, was originally in Sanskrit. And in Sanskrit, as I'm sure Dr. Rajapan will tell us, because he is an expert in Sanskrit, you have taught it, I think, at the Indian Institute of Technology, so he is an expert in Sanskrit. There are a number of different words that could be translated as mind. And this is, of course, one also of the problems that confronts one in working in Indian philosophy, which includes Buddhism. And that is that the terms mean different things in different schools. And so one has to be very careful of the way in which these terms. Even the word dharma, for example, has multiple meanings and means one thing in Indian philosophy itself and another thing in Buddhist philosophy. So one has to be very careful about terminology. And let's not, therefore, get too hung up on English words, which, after all, are translations for profoundly metaphysical concepts. And so we'll try to look at that a little bit. There are other problems. I think threefold problems. Three problems at least. There's the problem of contradictions. At the same time, for example, that one may say the mind is the slayer of the real, it's obvious throughout the Voice of the Silence that there must be an awakening of the mind, a proper use of the mind, a realization which can only come through the mind or through the illuminated mind, through that aspect of mind that we may want to call buddhimanas, if those terms are more familiar to us. So it is essentially the Voice of the Silence, to put it very simply, is a text about waking up. And that's all it is. It's a text about waking up and what it means to be awake, which, of course, is what it means to be Buddha. To be Buddha is to be awake. So it's a text about waking up. And our problem is that we're not awake. Our very serious problem is that we're not awake. And so we have the problem of contradictions, which is also the problem of authority. Whose authority? The interior authority, or is there an external authority? That, of course, leads to the problem of interpretation. And whose interpretation? So we will be exploring that, and I hope sharing a very great deal on that. In our probing, in our moving inward to understand. And there's the problem of organization in the sense of how we, well, let me put it this way. As you know, in the West, we are accustomed to sequential development. And this must take place before that. We must have a high school certificate before we assume we can enter university, for example. And we are sequential thinkers, and we like things neatly outlined, and that's why I suppose I allayed your curiosity as to where we're going by saying this is the sequence, you see. Now, the concept of all-at-onceness is therefore very difficult to convey, because words themselves are in sequence, aren't they? And if I say this, I have not said that. But what about an all-at-onceness, which is the waking up process? It's no longer process even. It's you're either awake or you're not awake. There is no such stage as half awake in this. So this is a problem of organization in that sense. So we will be looking at this, trying to understand it. In order to make some suggestions as to trying to understand the context, because obviously I'm not going to this morning examine, nor is it my purpose, and nor am I capable of doing it, examining the entire history of Buddhism and the rise of what have been called the two major schools. I think we need to look at it a little bit, but obviously we're not going to be able to pursue it fully. But if you are interested in seeing the total concept, the total context, there are a few books that I think are helpful. And perhaps one of the simplest and one of the basic, and certainly it has at the conclusion a very useful tabulated synopsis, which for a Western student who likes tabulations, it's very useful, is the Quest book by Hans Wolfgang Schumann, called Buddhism, An Outline of Its Teachings and Schools. And I highly recommend this. I think it is really one of our best works and very, very helpful in a basic outline of the whole field. Of course, undoubtedly, one of the finest writers on Buddhism and thoroughly familiar with it, and of course, a longtime member of the Theosophical Society and the founder of the Buddhist Society of London, was Christmas Humphreys. And his small paperback, Buddhism, I think, is still a classic and extremely useful. So again, it's very, very simple, very direct. He outlines some of the principles of the two major schools, and very helpful. Because Dr. D.T. Suzuki was familiar with the Voice of the Silence and did say that it was an authentic Mahayana text, I like Dr. Suzuki's outlines of Mahayana Buddhism. Now, again, these are just a few from, I have quite a library and not an extent, but even so not an extensive library on Buddhism, but these happen to be the ones that I think can be the most useful. And so for those who like to really try to understand in some depth these concepts that HPB is presenting in these fragments, these are a few that I recommend. There is a recent publication from Adyar, Theosophical Publishing House, that came out just last year, I believe, 1988, if I can ever turn the page. Yes, 1988. That I really highly recommend to understand something of what is meant by this clearing of the consciousness, clearing of the mind, to move into true meditation, the removal of the obstacles from the Buddhist point of view. And that's a little work. I'm not sure that it's even reached our bookshop yet, but if it has, and I haven't had time to check. I only got back, you know, last Thursday evening, is this little work called Buddhist Meditation by S. Rinpoche. Now, Rinpoche is an honorific, but he uses it because it's a simpler form to use it. His first name is Samdong Rinpoche. And he is the head of the Central Institute of Higher Tibetan Studies at Varanasi. He came to India in the retinue of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and at the request of the Dalai Lama, established this Central Institute of Higher Tibetan Studies. And he has given a series of talks at Adyar on various occasions, and I have met him. He's one of the most beautiful people, I think one of the most beautiful teachers that I've ever met in the Buddhist tradition. And this is a transcript of talks that he gave to students at the School of the Wisdom at Adyar in 1982. And it really is beautiful, very simple and very direct, and speaks of many of these profound Buddhist concepts, so that I would highly recommend it. It's just a beautiful little book, and certainly by a very beautiful person. Did you hear him, Rajapan?
Yes, sir.
Yes. And of course, he was there with the celebration of the centenary of the library when I was last there. So, so I simply recommend it as a little guide and helpful. Thank you, Nancy. I'm sorry, I'm still having some trouble after my long trip with all of that. Any questions or any comments so far? Anything anyone wants to ask, or have I talked too fast, or has this been of some interest and value?
What language was it that HPB memorized those verses from, do you know?
This is difficult to say. You see, thanks, Bob, because Bob has asked what language she would have memorized these verses in. She points to the fact that these verses, which formed part of the, she says, the Book of the Golden Precepts, were undoubtedly, therefore, part of the work from which she drew the stanzas on which the secret doctrine is based, from the books of Kyute. Would you agree? Nicholas, do you want to comment on the language?
This is just theory. I tend to think that we have a note here. I just noticed that Southern Indian language, which you can pronounce better than I can.
Pali.
You know, Telugu or?
Telugu.
There was a letter that, there was a version of the voice in that language that she was familiar with.
Yes.
Now, I don't think she knew that language. I suspect she translated it for herself and memorized her translation. But I don't think her Tibetan Sanskrit was too great.
I don't think either Tibetan or Sanskrit very much. She may have known more Sanskrit, I think, than even Tibetan, but well, it's hard to judge. In December 1895, in The Path, the journal of William Q. Judge, The Path, there's a letter from HPB to her sister, Madame Jelahovsky, and in it, HPB says the following about the voice of the silence. "They are grand aphorisms indeed. I may say so because I did not invent them. I only translated them from Telugu, the oldest South Indian dialect." Is that true that Telugu is the...
Mm-hmm.
And Telugu is mainly spoken in Andhra Pradesh, which is the state just north of Tamil Nadu.
Yes.
And many of our workers at Adyar speak Telugu. Yes, and so she says there are three treatises about morals and the moral principles of the Mongolian and Dravidian mystics. Now the Mongolian would place it in the north, and Dravidian would be in the south, which would be the original group in India, were the Dravidians, and very little touched by any of the invasions. In fact, I think that's the wonderful thing about South India, is that it was not really touched by any of the invasions which came from the north. The Aryan invasion, the Muslim invasion, and so on. The Dravidians of the south really maintained a purity, it seems to me.
That's cool.
And so this is a very interesting point that she makes. She says some of the aphorisms are wonderfully deep and beautiful. Now she says, I only translated them from Telugu. The extent to which she would have known Telugu, I really don't know.
Well, I think maybe a translation would have helped of either her hire the inner HPB, one of the teachers, not a sort of literary knowledge.
No, not a literary knowledge, certainly.
Just one comment from this one.
Yes.
Actually, this Mahayana, this someone is having translated into various Indian languages. Mm-hmm. Hindi, Telugu, Tamil, and there are some other languages probably you have not heard of, Malayalam. And these are very close to Sanskrit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the Sanskrit, probably Telugu is also one of the languages closest to Sanskrit.
Mm. That's interesting.
Very close to Sanskrit.
Mm-hmm. Very good. So it would appear, you see, that's her own commentary on it. And I think one that isn't very well known, perhaps, this statement in the path, in this letter. It's a letter to her sister, Madame Jelkowski. It appears, however, also to be, and she has indicated somewhere else, it seemed to me, that it was the same source from which the stanzas derived. Isn't there some reference to that, Nicholas?
In the beginning of the introduction, she talks about
the Book of the Golden Precepts, of course.
Book of John, I think.
Yes, she does. Yes.
Senzar.
And yes, the work from which I here translate forms part of the same series as that from which the stanzas of the Book of Zion were taken, on which the secret doctrine is based. Together with the great mystic work called Paramartha, which the legend of Nagarjuna tells us was delivered to the great Arhat by the Nagas, or serpents, the Book of the Golden Precepts claims the same origin. Yet its maxims and ideas, however noble and original, are often found under different forms in Sanskrit works, such as the Jnanashvari, that superb mystic treatise in which Krishna describes to Arjuna in glowing colors the condition of a fully illumined yogi, and again in certain Upanishads. And so on. So that, and she also says, the original precepts are engraved on thin oblong squares, copies very often on discs, and so on. In any event, this appears to be the source for it. Any other comments or questions?
One quick footnote in the Theosophical History Journal comes out for London, if anybody's seen it. A gentleman, a scholar, thought that this Paramartha,
mm-hmm.
there's a small poem, a devotional poem, that he thinks is actually what the Paramartha is, but I think if you study the context, and you'll see that Paramartha refers to the highest truth, which is in Tibet and China, and Tibet and India is the present Paramita teaching.
Oh,
yeah. A big corpus of teaching.
It's a huge corpus of teaching.
So it's not some little specific work.
No. No. If it does refer to the whole, Lam Rin, for example, of which that's a part, the books of QT, this is a huge corpus of Tibetan literature. Very large corpus, of which we have only very scattered fragments now available in English, coming to be available. Incidentally, as background, there appeared, I forgot to put the date, but in the American Theosophist, very recently, was it, forgot the date of it, the article written by Boris Dzerkhov, which he had intended to serve as an introduction to the edition of The Voice of the Silence that will appear as part of the collected writings, which has still to appear.
I'm so glad you said that.
Dara is responsible for this.
It seems like people have said, the key is already, but I felt that the way Boris moved the key to theosophy with the voice, that I'll have to look at it, and I have to confess it's been about 10 years since I've seen it in his office. It's now in the archives, so I really would need to study it. But I have a feeling he does give something to it, and you're mentioning,
yes,
I believe, the introduction to that.
Yes, he wrote this, and this we have published now in the American Theosophist, How the Voice of the Silence was written by Boris Dzerkhov, which I think he did intend to serve as an introduction. And it was never printed, but we are planning, our National Board of Directors has agreed that we do want to bring out the definitive edition of The Voice as prepared by Boris and with Dara's marvelous work, of course, carrying on Boris's and Nicholas. Yes, and Nicholas, her husband Nicholas. Yes. So that is on our agenda. So I have, for example, I went through Boris's annotated edition, which he showed me, and I have marked my own copy of The Voice of the Silence with all of, and made corrections where he made corrections in the spellings and in the diacritical marks and all of that as Boris had prepared it. So my edition reflects that very much, but that is all part of the archives, the Boris Dzerkhov archives at our headquarters, of course. And I might just mention, just because I don't want to get into this too much before the break, that at our headquarters we have the edition, first edition of The Voice of the Silence, presented to J.D. Buck, who of course was one of the early members of the Theosophical Society in this country and one of the founding members of the American section. And it's a perfectly beautiful little edition in which HPB has written to my esteemed colleague and friend, something like that, J.D. Buck. This is offered. And she, it's there also that she has written from HPB to H.P. Blavatsky with no kind regards. inserted in it is a very small little Japanese bookmark, and she adds that the Japanese bookmark included is impregnated with the life essence of the master to whom she offered, or from whom she really had received the work. It's a beautiful little book. I don't know if you saw it when you were at Alcock, but it's...
She didn't get a clue about her master, some other master?
Someone. She doesn't quite say who it was. But anyway, it's impregnated with that. And it's a beautiful little bookmark, and I've forgotten exact words. But if you go to Wheaton, there are times when that particular work is on display, and it's a beautiful little work. Well, shall we take our adjournment now then and continue then the discussion, get into some of the background. To turn then a little bit to this context of Mahayana Buddhism, when we say it is a Buddhist text, a Mahayana Buddhist text, we have to we could spend a great deal of time on the Buddhist background in which of HPB herself, of her teachers, and so on. But just briefly, that first of all, the word jnana has been translated in many ways. And when we say Mahayana, Maha is simply great, so a great, great jnana. I like the translation or the meaning that it is a course or a path or a way of transformation. When I say that what we're dealing with is a text of coming awake, it is a way of which, in which we transform what we are, what we seem to be, what we are externally, to that which we are essentially, which is to come awake to the true nature of ourselves. Now, one of the great problems, of course, that arises is that throughout the Voice of the Silence, the terms self, and I say terms because self with a small s, self with a capital S, self with a capital S, capital E, capital L, capital F, are used, which in many ways seem non-Buddhistic. To even use such a term seems outside the realm of Buddhist thought. So we will come to that in a moment, at least as I interpret it, and you may wish to interpret it in your way. Now, early on, Buddhism, very early on, Buddhism divided into what we can call two major schools. What was originally called, and for many years, Hinayana, Hina meaning small or lesser vehicle, the lesser path, the smaller, not so good, maybe not so great. Generally known, however, and they, the Hinayanists, prefer to be called the Theravadins, the Theravadists. So Theravada is the better word to use, which simply means the way of the elders. This was thought to be the original, and therefore the path of the elders. The Mahayana, the greater path, the path that was felt to be the transformation that was the supreme achievement, the really supreme achievement. And often there is spoken of as the Tantrayana, using the tantras, the way of movement by the reflection in the physical body through Kundalini, the chakras, and so on, a great deal of that. Now, even in the Mahayana, there are numerous schools. Obviously, we're not going to go into all of them. The school, however, that appears to be central and of the greatest school, perhaps, of Mahayana Buddhism is known as the Madhyamaka school of the great second century teacher, appears to be second century, Nagarjuna. And he had a great college and a great center in South India, in Andhra Pradesh, at Amaravati. And if you want to see reproduction, facsimiles of two of the sculptures that form the base of that, you can look on the wall in my office, where there are two of them, which I carefully brought back from Amaravati. And I thought, you know, when you go into a place that's, I wanted to visit where Nagarjuna had been, and that wonderful place. And I saw these, they're very heavy, available, and I thought, well, they'll cost far beyond anything I can afford. So I asked what they were. They were 5 rupees each. And when you consider that today, I think you get about 10 rupees to the dollar. Is that
20 rupees?
20, 18 rupees now to the dime, heavens. It's incredible. So you can see what 5 rupees, I think in those days I was getting maybe a little less than 10 rupees to the dollar, however. And so in any event, the two of them cost me, well, something under a dollar. You can see why I put them in my suitcase in spite of the weight of them, and brought them back. And there they hang on my wall. They are from Nagarjunakonda. Konda is a hill. Nagarjunakonda in Amaravati, in not far from Guntur in Andhra Pradesh. So if you want just a touch of it, at least you can look on the wall in my office and see it. Anyway, Nagarjuna was the great teacher of the Madhyamaka school, or the Madhyamikas, as the followers are called. And actually what that means is the middle way, which is the middle way. How would you translate it, Rajapan?
Madhyama is middle. That's
middle,
right.
Yes. Madhyama.
Yeah. Yes. In between these two.
Yes, okay. The middle. Yes, Madhyama is middle. And the ka is simply the way, that which is there. So it's the middle way. And I think that's nice that we follow the middle way. Sylvia?
I think you were talking about the supreme achievement.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And in the supreme achievement, we find the middle way.
Yeah. No, the middle way leads to the supreme achievement. One does not go, one does not go too far this way or too far that way, you see.
So
one does not have to be,
yes,
you see. Remember in the life of Gautama, and I think it represents it in a sense. Gautama, you remember when he left the palace, this is, of course, the life of the Buddha, the one who became Buddha. He became an ascetic. He starved himself, went on all kinds of fasts. He, you know, all of that, and did not achieve. He didn't wake up that way, he didn't come to enlightenment that way. He studied with the greatest teachers of the Upanishads, the Vedas and the Upanishads. He studied the scriptures. He, you know, was an absolute orthodox Brahmin to his fingertips. And that wasn't the way. And it was the discovery of the middle way. And Buddhism, in a sense, is that. Is, you know, one doesn't have to go to extremes. And so often it is said, in one of the sutras or one of the shastras, there are two classes of literature. We don't need to go into that, although I think this is the sutra class, which is the thread, which is the aphorism. The shastras are the commentaries. But in one of them, I think it's in one of the sutras, there it is said that the bodhisattva walk, I think it is like that of an elephant. And the elephant, having just been in Africa, I've seen the African elephant. I went to an elephant reserve, and so the African elephant is quite different from the Indian elephant. But in India, I rode an elephant a couple of times. I was on elephant back. And you just go from side to side, and the elephant plants its feet very firmly. Doesn't go to more to that side or more to the other side. So it's a, I think, a beautiful sort of image. So you can think of yourself as walking like an elephant, you know, not lumbering. The elephant doesn't lumber. He's very deliberate and knows exactly where he puts his foot. So it's the middle way, the middle path. And that is the way to this supreme achievement, to this. So it may help to recognize that. So now, the middle way, the middle path, and that is the way to this supreme achievement, to this. So it may help to recognize that. So now, Nagarjuna, then, actually there are the major treatise that forms the whole basis of the Madhyamaka school, sometimes called the Sunyatavada school, but we don't need to go into that. It's Sunyata is this doctrine of emptiness. Probably the major sutra is known as the Prajnaparamita. Now, that's only in case you ever come across that. Prajna is, of course, and I think we can put it this way. I can get myself entangled here. What am I doing? Entangled up here somehow. Prajna, we can translate as wisdom, insight, discrimination. Jna, of course, is jnana, is wisdom. How would you translate prajna?
Prajna is simply consciousness.
Consciousness.
Real consciousness.
Yes, real consciousness. Pure, unadulterated consciousness. Consciousness uncolored by emotion. Consciousness, you see, our consciousness is all muddied, isn't it? Our thoughts are muddied. Our consciousness is muddied. It's colored by all sorts of things. So prajna is the uncolored consciousness. And here the voice of the silence deals with the consciousness that is uncolored, in which, therefore, there is karuna, which is compassion, which is consciousness that is by its very nature all-embracing, because there is only one consciousness, and therefore it is compassion. And one of the most beautiful of the aphorisms in the voice is, compassion is no attribute, it is the law of laws, because it is ultimate. And the way, therefore, the way is known as upaya, or skillful means. How does one unite this? How does one bring about this consciousness that is in its very nature compassion? Compassion. And that we'll be talking about a little bit further when we come to some of these. But therefore, there is a means, there is the path, but it is upaya, the skillful means. Would you translate it differently, or?
No, upaya, I had only one word to say, would you pronounce it? Upaya.
Yes.
That's my
is this a long A?
See, usually you put A.
Yes, Yes. I always forget the diacritical marks.
No, upaya.
That's what I thought, that it was a, that's what I meant, that it was a.
And what is upaya supposed to be?
Upaya means the
skillful means.
Or the way to reach.
Yes, the
way. The mechanism.
Yes, the mechanism. It's the skillful means.
To that pure consciousness.
To this pure consciousness, which is karuna.
So the sense is the method.
It's the method.
Upaya.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, as you know, in Sanskrit, there's the So the.
So we have to have I would gather that from what I see there, we have to have a clean mind to develop willpower to make the next step. Is that what they're driving at? Not quite. Huh?
Not quite. And it's not a willpower. It's a bringing the mind or consciousness into its original state. What is the original state of consciousness? In the Christian tradition, in a sense, except you become as little children, it's the childlike mind. It's the mind that is pure. Nicholas?
I was just going to say that upaya can also be a method of helping others, a method of leading them on
it.
And that in itself is a method for us too.
Yes, that's right. And this, of course, leads us to, when we come to the two paths, the bodhisattva vow, you see, that the skillful means is that one helps others.
And in the
very helping of others, one comes to this.
Compassion in a vacuum.
No, that's right. Yes, nothing exists in a vacuum. This can lead us into many, many aspects of it.
skillful part of skillful means is realizing one's limitations and being able to help.
Yes.
To be able to say to yourself, I can only help you this far, rather than say, well, I have the best of intentions and completely making a mess of
efforts. That's right.
And that, I think, is the middle way, too.
That's right.
Balancing your abilities with your
That's right, yes. And skillful means, you see, let us take an example. If you're teaching a baby, an infant, to walk, the baby is taking his first steps, do you hold the child every single moment?
No.
There's a moment when you let go, even if he falls, isn't that right? But you have to let go, and that's, when is the moment when you let go? If you continue to hold the child every single moment, he's never going to learn to walk on his own, is he?
So
this is the middle way. You take his hand for one step. You let go, perhaps, for the second step. Do you see? There's a middle way. You don't let him go, you know, rushing off and tumbling downstairs. So you don't go to that extreme. You don't go to the extreme of keeping hold of his hand for every single moment until he's an adult. So there is always this middle way, which is the skillful means.
All that is finding the way of a relationship with the next person or with the next.
Yes, as Evelyn said, compassion is not in a vacuum. Yes. But you see, what is the middle way in it? How do we really help? Anyway. So
I don't think you can translate that with common sense. It's not exactly common sense.
Not exactly, but that's involved in it, of course, Sylvia. Common sense is involved.
Craft. To know one's craft.
To know one's craft, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, really is. Well, I have suggested, you see, that really one could also call this the voice of the silence the bodhisattva jnana. But we'll come to that and we'll see that unfold. And we'll, don't worry about that word. But I'd like to look just briefly at least at three aspects then, which I call doctrines. I have divided this perhaps not quite as some of the authors do, but because I think that the teachings indicate that these are really the three doctrines. The doctrine of emptiness, which is also known as, tangled up here, sunyata. Now is it over that final A?
Sunyata, that's right.
Isn't it?
That's okay.
Isn't that right?
Yeah.
Do you want to put any other diagram? There's another diagram.
Actually,
you better come.
Sorry.
No, fine, Rajapan. Now we got someone.
See, here there's a dot.
There's a dot under that.
Su.
Yes, su.
Not su, su.
Su. Su. Sunyata.
Sunyata.
Yes. Now, usually this is translated as emptiness. But it's also an emptiness that is a fullness, that is a suchness. It's also been translated as suchness, the isness, if you like. It's an emptiness of sometimes, isn't this sometimes almost like that? Isn't it?
No, it's a little explanation.
Uh-huh.
If you don't mind, may I?
Uh-huh.
So there's a saying in one of the Upanishads that Shunyata doesn't mean emptiness.
Uh-huh.
Shunyata means it's full of things, full of energy.
Uh-huh. Yes, it's full of energy.
Full of energy.
Yes.
You see, there's one of the Upanishads, I think it is Chandogya Upanishad, the teacher calls the student, you bring me a fruit from that tree, you bring a tree.
Mm-hmm.
He breaks it,
what
do you see? There is nothing.
Uh-huh.
Then the teacher tells the student, look, it is from this nothing that the whole tree is.
That the whole tree comes, yes.
And this is in essence what modern nuclear science is.
Mm-hmm.
When they call field, field is full of energy. There is nothing like emptiness.
Yes.
Emptiness means full of emptiness.
Yes, yes, it's full of emptiness, and that's why I put it in quotes, because in the Buddhist texts, you will, or in these various works on Buddhism, you'll frequently find it defined as emptiness.
But it can also be just simply emptiness of any particular manifestation.
That's right, yes.
It depends on which way you look at it.
That's right.
It's empty, so it's full of everything.
It's full of everything and full of no thingness. John's favorite word. No specific thingness, but of energy, of vitality, you see. So it is really, in that sense, non-individualized Atman, but it is the universality of that presence. Can we put it that way? The universality of that presence. So there is no self-ness, but there is all self. And this is where we get into these contradictions in the voice of the silence. So in that sense, you see, as indeed it has been said, that, and HPB herself points out, that there is no distinction between this Madhyamaka school and Advaita Vedanta. And you remember when we discussed the theosophical worldview, it is non-dual. It's non-dual, it is Advaita, you see. And indeed, it's been said that the Buddhist counterpart, or rather adaptation, it's the Madhyamika. Madhyamika is founded by Nagarjuna. The Buddhist counterpart or adaptation of the scholastic Vedanta, but it's Advaita Vedanta, it's the non-dual. So hence, this concept of no individual self. And of course, that's where the Theravadins, you know, really have this the anatta doctrine, no individualized self. Because it is all self, we're one. Because there is, therefore, this, however, this seeming duality and this seeming individual self, there is in the manifested universe dukkha, which is usually translated as suffering, but which I think we can say that there, it's not simply suffering, as I've often pointed out, but rather that it is a condition of, in which there's nothing that is satisfactory. It's not that suffering is bad, but that all is changing. So it is really also the doctrine of impermanence, because everything is kind. Nothing remains the same. Nothing ever remains the same. Constantly changing, but we hold on to it, and therefore dukkha. It is not satisfying. Even pleasure is suffering. Even pleasure is pain. Therefore, from this point of view, you see, until one comes to this realization. Consequently, I think the second one is that there is that universality, that oneness, that non-dissolvability, which is alaya, because alaya simply means from li, a, to dissolve, not to dissolve. The non-dissolvability of consciousness, vijnana, non-dissolvability of consciousness, an ultimate. So it's a doctrine of mind only. So when one says, mind is the slayer of the real, what are we looking at? Not this ultimate consciousness in which all is present. Mind only. Hence the importance of meditation to bring the mind, consciousness, into this condition, you see, to become aware, to come awake. And for what purpose? To return to one's original state, which we can call liberation, which is nirvana. Now, we have to look very closely at that. There are many ways of talking about nirvana. I think that we can say the verbal root is va, to blow, and nir, not to blow. Not to be blown about is the way I like to call it. Often it's said to blow out like a candle, to extinguish like a candle. But I prefer looking at it from the point of view that it means that one is no longer blown about in the world. The mind is no longer blown about. And it can be, I'm told, looked at from that point of view. But we'll look at it more closely as we go along. So that now consciousness, you see, there's a, to me, one of the really magnificent aphorisms in the voice occurs, I've forgotten just where it occurs, but in any event, it's a magnificent aphorism. Alas, alas, that all men possessing alaya, it so little benefits them. That we're all immersed in, that we are this universal consciousness. That this is the only consciousness that is, and it really doesn't really do much for us. That is because we're not aware of it. So there is that. I don't find it at the moment. I never find these things when I want them. Well, I would suggest that that probably is enough to indicate the central teachings in the context of which this little work arises. Any comments, discussion?
How's that different from Tantra Yama?
The method, the skillful means, of course, one can use the tantric methods, which are, can be very dangerous, can also be very, you know, the greater the benefit, also the greater the danger in one sense. I mean, there are serious risks. So it is in the means that are used. Generally, the means that are being presented here are the means through the bringing of consciousness into its original state through meditation, but it can be done, and I think there are indications here even, through the proper awakening of Kundalini, which is tantric. And as you probably know, Lowell, there are some who feel that indeed the stanzas of Jian have their basis in some of the tantric system, which may well be some of the tantric sutras.
So the voice of the sky, the voice of the silence, just pure and unadulterated Buddhism.
Yes, original Buddhism.
It's not something that he created, he's just bringing what was there. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. That passage that you referred to in verse 107, 5-2.
Oh, thank you. Oh yes, 107. Alas, alas, that all men should possess alaya, be one with the great soul, and that possessing it, alaya, should so little avail them. So wonderful.
And what is alaya now?
Alaya is that non-dissolvable, universal essence.
That non-dissolvable.
There's another interpretation which Buddhists seem to be more comfortable with. Alaya has an abode or a source,
mm-hmm.
a source of consciousness everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
This other interpretation that the Indians use a lot, but I don't think it's quite as common in Buddhism.
Mm-hmm. This is true. It probably isn't.
Mm-hmm. Interesting that the word aliyah in Hebrew means the coming back to the source.
Oh, it does.
People who moved Jews from all the world to go to Israel and to recognize it as their homeland are making an aliyah.
Aliyah. It's probably related because, of course, it's part of the Indo-European tongue. Yes. Interesting.
Yeah, the word means to go up.
Uh-huh.
Let's go with me.
A-L-E-Y-A.
In Hebrew?
Yeah.
A-L-I-Y-A-H.
Okay.
He grew up, he was a...
Very interesting, yes. Well, this is probably true, and of course the Alaya Vinyana in Buddhism then is the storehouse, this...
Like the Himalaya is the source of the...
Yes, the source of, yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Master soul is one, yes. Universal.
Well, this book you mentioned, by S. Rinpoche, Buddhist Meditation, is it going to be available in the Trust Bookstore?
Oh, yes, it will be, because it comes from Adyar, and this was brought to me in England last summer, and I really should have checked it. You know, it takes so long for these things to reach here from Adyar, but I will speak to Sylvia and be sure that it is available in the bookstore, because it should be coming. It's very helpful. It's a beautiful little work.
No.
Upaya is skillful means by which one achieves the that consciousness which is in its very nature compassion.
Alaya.
No. Alaya is that in which we're all, it's the storehouse of, if you like, to follow the what Nicholas has said, Alaya is the universal
source.
When we reach there.
Now consciousness is there.
Means a little further.
Yes.
I am the source from which all these things come. Himalaya, you correctly put it very correctly. Himalaya means that the source of all the snow. This is how it is interpreted.
Yes. Yes. So Alaya, we are all, that is our original source.
Yes.
You see. Now the consciousness of that,
okay.
To know that, to be that, to be one with that.
That is the end. Is there a word for it?
That's prajna. That's prajna.
Oh, that's prajna.
Prajna, wisdom, insight. Well, I just wanted to set it within that, because it seems to me, looking at these three particular doctrines, is helpful to see that HPB was trained in this, remember. This was her training. This was her particular way in which she, her teachers had taught her. And therefore, as I say, I think there is that, she gives this then to her students as a way. One has to really, I think, ponder upon it and meditate upon it. I think that's part of the beauty of it, is to really try to delve into it. So I don't want to tear it apart too much, but to recognize what it is we're about in taking up this work. It is.
It's interesting to note that Paul Button says if you're gentle with yourself, and you put no pressure on your own personality or your own consciousness, you'll also learn not to put pressure on anybody else's consciousness. Which is a very, like being tender to yourself, you'll also be tender to other people, you'll be gentle.
I think one of the, there has been a lot of difficulty, I think, in many of the interpretations of Buddhism in these three areas of the Anatta doctrine, the doctrine of emptiness, Shunyata, the doctrine of mind only, the doctrine of Nirvana, which is simply that emptiness. It comes back to that. It's what Schumann calls the upaya, the means, is an emptiness attitude. That is, that the mind does not cling to anything. And our minds do. We're I think we have minds like sticky tape. You know, whatever, you know, whatever we see, we hold it, we keep it. The image is there, you see. And so that becomes important. And now, and then we no longer see what is, but we see the image of what is. And we no longer look at anything afresh, but only the image of what is there.
Volume 14 of the Collected Writings, HP has an article there on comparing Buddhist teaching with the Western European context, kind of interesting regarding what you said about this false idea of blowing out.
Yes, yes.
Well, it means also blowing out the fire of suffering and samsara.
Yes, it does, yes. But you see, for Nagarjuna, and I think again the middle way, for Nagarjuna, it was not then release into nirvana from the point of view of abandoning the world by any means. Because his famous statement, nirvana is samsara, samsara is nirvana, between the two there is no difference. That it's an attitude, it's a consciousness with which we approach all of life. Samsara is the world of existent things. But right here, the mind is no longer blown about by all of these existent things, which is why I like this idea of it. It's not to be blown about, and we are blown about, you know, by our passions, by our greeds, by our jealousies, by our hatreds, by our loves and our happinesses, and we're blown about by everything, and not to be blown about. In the Bhagavad Gita, the yogi of stable mind. Mm-hmm. Stable mind. So he's not blown about. And so, even in the midst of, so it's not withdrawal somewhere. Of course, it's very easy not to be blown about if one is in a place where there is, you know, one doesn't have to be with other people in relationship.
I don't want to change the subject then. It connects very much with what we started today with, the attitude towards compassion.
That's right.
Which is so vilified, so polarized, so artificial, the way it has been developed in this country.
Yes.
And it's so refreshing to see there is another aspect.
That's right. And, you know, it's our own country has been vilified, you see, the United States. You travel overseas and sometimes you see what appears in the movies that are shipped over, and the media say that what goes on, you see, and I'm told, well, it certainly you never go into Los Angeles, do you? And I say, yes, of course. No, but it can't be safe to go into Los Angeles. Well, is it safe, darling?
Well, where we live is
relatively safe.
It is less. I guess I would say that about certain parts of life.
Yes, I mean, there are certain parts I wouldn't walk in, but there are other parts certainly that are beautiful, aren't they?
Well, yeah, when they say, right, the principle of certainty,
yes.
So you have both.
So, you see, what is safe these days? Now, if you're not going to be blown about, you're always safe. You're safe because you have an attitude of emptiness. So you can, you see, I think, I can't remember if he mentions it in here. He speaks about memory, so that way you'll be interested, Nancy. But you see, when we look at a tree, I think he mentions this. Anyway, if you look at a tree, and you see it, and you say, that is a tree, of course, and you recognize it, and then you say, no, it's an oak tree, and so on. Now, what is in your mind is that image of the tree. So when you look at it again, are you looking at the tree, or are you looking at the image of the tree in your mind?
All the concepts connected with it, ecology.
That's right.
Deforestation.
Yes, who knows, you see, and we begin to see that, do we see the tree in terms of the amount of lumber it may produce to build a house? Are we thinking of the tree in protecting it ecologically? Are we looking at the tree for, you know, if you're looking for a shady place to have a picnic, you may say that's a nice tree for a picnic, to have a picnic under. And so you see the tree not as the tree, but for its shade, and so on, all of the various aspects. And now all of that's kept in the image, in the mind. And so when you see a tree, it's the image, it's no longer the tree. So the emptiness attitude is that you see the tree every time, not the image.
In order to see the tree, then we have to identify the spirit of the tree.
We have to, we don't identify any, we simply see the tree.
Yes,
simply see it at the moment.
Dr. Dehart was saying about some efforts at meditation that he used to have. He was living in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. And he got involved inside the tree, and then he said he couldn't get out of it. To me, I didn't understand.
Well, don't. But you see, therefore, it's this, and I like the word emptiness from that point of view. It's a non-stickiness attitude. Maybe that's another word could be used, in which the consciousness now is in its original condition. Not easy.
HPB uses sound, mm-hmm. which he says voice in the silence.
Mm-hmm.
Another paradox, you could say it would be like the vision of emptiness.
Yes.
In other words, it's...
Mm-hmm. It's seeing emptiness, yes. And you see, therefore, in
or
one...
Seeing with emptiness.
Or seeing with emptiness. You see, HPB, well, in the voice, too, she refers, of course, to the Four Noble Truths of Buddhism. And the fourth of the Noble Truths is known as the Eightfold Path. And the very first step on this path is right views, or right understanding, or right seeing. And in some aspects, the whole Buddhist approach can be divided into two paths, the path of seeing and the path of paying attention to that which has been seen. But first of all, the path of seeing. And this is right view.
I can't imagine how one would see anything without programming it with your inner imagery. I just mm-hmm. can't imagine forgetting it. I mean, mm-hmm. I can imagine mm-hmm. with my thinking, but mm-hmm. I really can't imagine how mm-hmm. one would do that as long as one is alive.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the purpose of...
This is the whole process, though, of meditation, you see, is to unprogram yourself.
To see things as everything is an aggregate. In other words, to see that tree as being a collection of leaves, of bark, of other abilities, but also other things in the plant kingdom have also. In other words, there are eucalyptus that smell like lemon.
But you're still using every bit of your imagery, everything you're saying right now.
But to realize that...
It's what you read, or what you felt, or what you thought, or what you heard.
That's part of the middle way. That's part of the middle way. Because part of the middle way is to acknowledge the fact that everything is an aggregate and has no inherent existence. And on the other hand, that you also have these imageries, these connotations, and all these other things that may have been misconceptions as well as skillful means. And so you balance. You're constantly in a state of integrating and balancing your prejudices, your knowledge, the truth that you know, your peculiarities, idiosyncrasies, against the fact that all of it is aggregational. That the real basis is energy is nothing, is emptiness, but the real truth is not true nihilism or true materialism, but you're constantly balancing nihilism against materialism, and to get in touch with your own material biases, as well as getting to understand the emptiness process of constantly taking apart the aggregational aspects of the material world.
Mm-hmm.
We actually need the tree. We give the tree carbon dioxide, and it turns around and gives us back oxygen. And that's perfect love.
That's the purpose of this glass, to keep it clean.
Well, maybe
the
amount
of that condition.
One example is the difference between just plain awareness and the content of the awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the difficult part. Think of something you saw for the very first time, you had no idea what it was. In that instant, there was nothing there.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't even say it was a shape, there was just something there. Well, that is something like what
then you have no relationship to it.
Well, that's fine. That's fine. Non-attachment is one of those...
Sometimes you would take those little patterns of how that looked like a vase and a face.
Mm-hmm.
At the first instant, you see nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you say, oh, there's a face and a vase in this thing. Mm-hmm. And then it's telling you something, and then you're relating to it. But like you're saying, it's the first time you see the image and you don't know what it is, it's just nothing.
We're not used to it yet. There's something. But you have to stay in that state.
But then how, I don't get the pain. Well, I don't want to.
So you can't have real quick.
I agree, Jane. It's not easy. It's not easy. What's aimed at is not easy, and you're absolutely right, Jane.
We are not in that position. And the expression, but it's in all of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The problem is to go to where she's the right to be.
And of course, where words really are the stumbling block, too.
I think you have to learn to savor that instant before you start putting all your patterns on it.
Mm-hmm.
That minute of where it doesn't, you just see it like a loud noise.
Mm-hmm.
And before you jump, before you say, what is that, when you react, that moment, that split instant of insight, of a pure being, before you apply anything to it, is something like that. So I think what one has to do is to identify it and then separate out that moment when you start putting your stuff against that pure perception. And then to savor that pure perception and to see it grow.
Mm-hmm.
And to just culture that.
I sort of get the impression that we're not just going to switch.
Yeah.
It's not like you're always in this state or that.
Mm-hmm.
But well, there is a function of this simple awareness.
Mm-hmm. I think this is true, and I think this may be what is meant in the letter, which Master Cage said, we're adepts only when acting as such. In other words, there is that consciousness which can be present. But when we move about the world, we need the world's consciousness. True. It's not easy, I grant you, Jim.
That's why Buddha's teachings were called against the current. The way we approach everything.
Yes.
Turn it 180 degrees, and that's the way it's supposed to be.
Yes. 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 All right. Well, anyway, that's enough, I think, for today, and we can continue on. Think about it anyway. Kind of consider it. We'll continue on Wednesday.